Up next, from the Center for Social Innovation at Stanford, Richard Migliori, Executive Vice President of United Health Group's Health Services, paints a picture of the healthcare system that is fragmented, widely variable, and misaligned with patients' needs. What is needed to confront these massive inefficiencies, he says, is new technologies and lower cost outcomes.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer.
And I'm Eric Nee.
Today, we're excited to partner with both the Program for Healthcare Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business and the Center for Global Health at the Stanford School of Medicine to bring you a special conversation on the future of healthcare.
This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter. And now, here's our presentation from our healthcare series.
Let me share with you the perspective of United Health Group on innovation in healthcare, and it's probably shared by many payers, but I would contend that it's also shared across our industry, and including John's. Innovation in healthcare space is our lifeblood, particularly United Health Group. It's our basis for maintaining an adaptive capability so that we can weather the storm and also anticipate future trends and then be proactive and help shape trends. For us, the innovation has three components. Number one, it's got to be strategic. What I mean by that, it's got to be able to improve clinical or economic outcomes, improve access, or improve patient experience. Second, it's got to be compliant. And I'm not just talking about regulatory compliance or compliance with information. It also has to be compliant with evidence-based medicine. After all, we're in the healthcare business. And then the third component, it has to be scalable. We serve 70 million people. There are 313 million Americans. In order for these types of programs to have merit, they can't be nurses on phones. It's got to be something that can spread and to create. The final aspect of things, if we're going to be true to our soul, is that we have to leverage our core competencies, of which we have three. One is the ability to organize and to manage within a healthcare delivery system of providers, and we work with 85% of America's healthcare delivery providers, hospitals, physicians, pharmacies, etc. The second, it can leverage technology for transactions. We manage some 52 billion transactions a year. So we have to be able to have that kind of ability, and that experience can help drive some of our thinking. And then the final component, it has to be able to leverage knowledge. It's no longer just good enough to keep all of your claims in a shoebox so that you can pass a claim audit. Those claims tell you something. They tell you about consumption of healthcare, who's getting it, why they're getting it, how effective it's being delivered. But let's get to that first point. Let's be strategic. Healthcare reform brings us great promise. It already has clear pathway to expanding coverage to more people. What it doesn't have to date is a pathway to sustainability. And that sustainability is only going to come by your ability to manage costs. This is work that comes from Elliott Fisher. It's out of the Dartmouth Group. And it demonstrates for you a couple of things. Number one, that there's a dramatic variation and disparity in the cost of care per capita across the United States. Fact is, there's a twofold difference between Minneapolis and Manhattan. And you can see scattered across the country different levels of expenditure. That expenditure, first and foremost, is not just a reflection of the unit cost per service. It's far deeper than that. But in all areas, it continues to grow at some 3 to 4% per annum over the course of about this 14-year period. The driving focus of that comes from this dynamic. It's the decisions made on a day-to-day basis in the exam rooms, in the emergency rooms, in the operating rooms across America between these two people. And that decision that they're about to make is fully dependent upon the quality of information they have about the patient, the physician's awareness and willingness to employ evidence-based medical standards, and third, their ability to track progress or even compliance even. When you start looking at the American healthcare system's ability to make decisions, however, you find the source of the variation that Elliot Fisher was showing. This is work that goes back to Jack Weinberg, and it gets repeated on a regular basis. The only thing that changes about these charts is that the absolute number of cases per year grows. These are America's 10 most common surgical procedures, and what they represent are regional variation in the utilization rates of these procedures, where this is a community, a hospital referral region of in Louisiana versus in Minneapolis for here for doing angioplasty. And though this is, data is a little dated, this is getting repeated on, you know, with year over year. There's a 12-fold difference here in the likelihood that this procedure will be performed. That is not driven by differences in the presence of disease or the epidemiology of those communities. That 12-fold difference is small area variation driven by the decision-making processes that are different in those environments. Let me say it a little differently. In this country, you are more likely to have your plan of care influenced by your zip code than the stage of your disease. We have an issue with utilization. We have an issue with utilization driven by decision-making. When you talk to Elliot Fisher, his estimate is that 30% of our expenditures could be reduced if we would have more of a normalization of this type of variation. Now, some other evidence about decision-making quality in the country is here. This was Elizabeth McGlynn's work, where she looked at tens of thousands of decisions in her clinical practice and found that 45% of the time, the decisions made by the practitioner had no basis in science. In fact, in 11% of those decisions, they're actually potentially harmful. Here's the other person in the room, the behavior of the individual. We talked about the 55% being incoherent with medicine. However, one out of five people handed a prescription never fill it, though they go back and tell a physician that they did. Of those people who do fill it, 50% of them will stop taking it within 6 months, particularly if it's for an asymptomatic cause. And you can see the expenditures, and this is probably an underestimate, of hospitalizations in this country because of poor compliance. Then we have this influence on decision-making processes. About half of the growth in healthcare expenditure over more broad indications of price and CPI comes from new innovation. But unlike what you probably would anticipate coming out of me, this is an absolute necessity. We cannot continue to sustain the healthcare system without the introduction of these new technologies. We have to be able to achieve outcomes at a lower cost, and you're only going to get there with better tools than we have currently. But it does provide a new area of complexity for people making decisions. So, as we started looking at creating solutions around this area, we recognized we needed to achieve three things. One of them, we need to work to make the healthcare system more connected. It's far too fragmented, and I won't go into much more than that. Certainly, we have to make decision-making processes more intelligent, better information. And I'll get into that in a second. And certainly, we need to have all participants, whether they're consuming care, delivering care, paying for care, or adding new devices or pills or whatever to the system, or even regulating it. Getting people aligned is going to be ultimate. So let's go back to that exam room. There were going to be three things that we felt that we could bring to the table, one of which is if we could use our data gathering capabilities to help inform this dyad better so that they know what's going on in this guy's background. Second, if she's out of medical school more than 5 years, medical information's probably doubled. While she's been working on her patient base, she may not be keeping up with her knowledge base, and we can automate that for her. And then finally, the ability to track what's happening, because We saw the issue. He's clearly not following his dietary restrictions. He may not be taking his pills. In order to do that, we built out a system, a platform called eSync. What eSync does is it looks at our entire population of 70 million Americans and collects all clinical data that we have on them, whether it's claim data, whether it's pharmacy data, whether it's clinical laboratory data, whether it's medical notes, et cetera, and bills for each individual a composite view of their lives. And then we use analytic tools through a rules engine to first organize that data to infer what conditions this individual may have, building out their problem list, and then examining using 950 evidence-based rules what we, for each condition, a look at what kind of care they had delivered and where versus what was expected on evidence-based rules, and then look for errors of omission and errors of commission, and build out for each individual something called a personal action plan, which shows the opportunities to develop more conformity with evidence-based standards. Well, in order to get that plan to do something, we ended up finding that we were most effective if we were sharing that with the consumer themselves, things for them to do, but also share that same to-do list with their physician, all of them, and if we're involved because we have nurse managers and the like, then with our own staff. So you have everybody working on the same concurrent platform, everybody on the same prioritized to-do list. When we did that, as we demonstrate in blue, the likelihoods of conformity to evidence-based standard improved an incremental 20%. So we can influence the power of a decision. The issue that we face, however, is getting people to adapt it and to adopt those changes so they can adapt their behaviors. People are different. And one of the things that we recognized that we need to become more of an integral part of people's lifestyle. We have all of this data, but to get people to look at it, we realize we have to be different. Whether we are reaching out to them by having our nurses reaching out to our sick and most ill people, or gaining other people who may be interested themselves through portals, or getting into their lives with mobile applications, or for those who are still find themselves a victim of snail mail, to be able to reach them that way, so that everybody gets to see that personalized to-do list. Let me give you a couple of examples of that. This is the nurse's desktop. When they go in the morning, they get to see who their patient is, and then they start looking at some opportunities to change behavior. The type of behaviors that we look for are things they can be doing about, are they seeing the right type of doctor? Are they on the right medication? Are they on the right care platform? Or even, are they living the right lifestyle? In this case, let's look at an example where the nurses decided that we're going to go look at the physician that they've chosen for their problem. This person has diabetes. Clearly, this person did not have an internist. One of the things that the system does is to generate internists who are nearby and also provides quality ratings based on her experience. What's this physician's natural history of conforming to evidence-based standards in their practice and doing it efficiently? And in so doing, selecting physicians and helping the patient by providing them mapping instructions, and then we'll even go so far as to make the appointments for them. But if we're going to do that, we also need to be able to provide that. Thank you. We also need to be able to provide that in the hands of individuals who do this themselves. We can only reach out to as many as maybe 5, 6, or 7% of the population who are driving 40%. For the rest of the population, it's self-service. And encouraging people to do so required the way in which we present data online. One of the things we've done is to be able to show people their personal action plan by showing them where they stand. What is their medical history, and put it in front of them in a layer in our portal called IAM, the things that they need to do to correct it in a layer called I Do, and then what we're seeing more and more from employers and even governments is applying a layer that shows tracking with financial incentives and a variety of other incentives based on some sound behavioral economic theory to get this I Am, I Do, I Get philosophy so we can drive behavior, and it's had some rather encouraging results. But we also have to be able to get to people and share this same personalized action plan, things they can do to make better decisions by putting it in their pocket. One of the things to do is to take that very same physician identifying thing and put it right into a mobile application. In fact, this is available for you if you want. Just merely load it down in your app store, whether you're on a Droid, a BlackBerry, or a or an Apple phone, this application is free. It will show you, looking whether you're looking for a physician, a facility, or a healthcare center, the list of physicians by specialty and their encouragement. In fact, we'll make the appointment for you if you're one of our members. But we also wanted to be able to get into lifestyle, and this is a new platform that we've created, again, being driven off those same personalized action plan. It's called Optimize Me. It is also free. You can download this thing. It's on Droid-based and as well as on the Windows Phone 7. It's a way in which people socialize. One of the things we recognize that if people have a relationship, people's relationships are important, social distance is important. The Framingham study even showed it, where it showed that if you have a first degree contact, that is a family member or a close personal friend who becomes obese, your chances of becoming obese go up 57%. This isn't that fat people get together. This is that if there's a change in behavior of somebody in your group, you have a 50% chance change in that behavior. It goes likewise the other way. People losing weight will create a collective. So what this is a way of creating for people challenges. It's a four squares game. It's a platform that shows a variety of challenges and badging and a variety of other things, but it also is a means by which people can administer incentive plans through their employer for wellness activities. The final thing that we're doing is moving into this space, create a greater connectivity between patient and the physician, with the evolution of a variety of the different tablet devices and smartphones, the ability to connect patient-centered activity with physician under the patient's control where they can release data going forward. As this evolves, it gets us to go to one last place that I'll finish up with, is the ability to take this intelligence and technology and use it to solve a problem with access. We are going to be 45,000 primary care physicians short in this country by 2015, according to the American Association of Medical Colleges. There's not enough healthcare access to go around. Look at what's being reported now in Massachusetts. Massachusetts Medical Society recognizes now that when they increased coverage under Romney's plan, one of the things that happened is that the waiting time for physicians extended dramatically and emergency room utilization went up. It now takes 49 days to get a primary care appointment. The healthcare system cannot grow fast enough to accommodate the new demand that's going to be uncovered with the expansion of coverage. We need to find new solutions. One of the new solutions is to take people with current clinical licenses and increase their game. How? By sharing information. By sharing technology, using mobile applications, using telemedicine solutions as we've started, and as well as even making these things as a rotating service. The ability is to provide a remote clinician at a given level with support of a more specialized clinician in a more centralized setting, and by using telecommunications to spread that intellect.
You've been listening to a conversation in our healthcare series. To learn more about the Center for Healthcare Innovation at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, visit gsb.stanford.edu/phi. To learn more about the Center for Global Health at the Stanford School of Medicine, visit globalhealth.stanford.edu. This podcast is brought to you by the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental problems. To be the first to learn about our latest published conversation and for more social innovation ideas, follow us at SOC Innovators on Twitter.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Mark Walker. Our website editor was Marguerite Rigoglioso. The series producer is Zach Jensen.
I'm Chris Deigelmeyer.
And I'm Eric Nee. Thanks for listening.